Welcome to the Anima podcast, where we explore design with soul. I'm Ayla Angelos, deputy editor of Anima, the design magazine that explores what things mean as well as how they look and feel. In every episode, we'll be talking to the people whose work and ideas have shaped the way that we all live, and the people who are going to be changing our lives in the future. This episode's guest is Samuel Ross, the British artist and designer who over the last 12 months has shown his art at London's Whitecube Gallery, exhibited his furniture at Friedman Bender in New York, and unveiled his bathroom designs for Cola. We talked about his evolution over the years, how he views his career as chunks of time that should be renewed every decade, and what's next after selling his stake in his business, A Cold Wall, a fashion label that he began from his home 10 years ago. Where are you dialing in from today?
I got back to London last night at about 11 p.m. I was in Santiago in Spain, looking at some new apparel manufacturers, which is very exciting, having had quite a bit of substantial news come out this week, actually, which has been great.
Is this on the down low, substantial news?
No, it's out. It's public. It's public now. I saw The Cold Wall.
Oh, my gosh. Of course. Yes. That is very big news.
Indeed. It feels good. So it's now, you know, prepping for like the next advent in what, you know, garment and apparel can be, with a much more, I'd say, specific vernacular and demographic in mind.
How does it feel to have sold something that you know, manifested from the get-go?
It's interesting, actually. You kind of go from like literally like a bedroom business to like multiple global retail, like physical stores. But I also looked at it from like a time perspective of, I spent a third of my life will be building out one particular perspective. And I think it's important to understand you may only get, you know, 8 to 9 decades if you're lucky. And I've had one of those allocated to A Cold Wall. So I think there always needs to be this threshold of newness which comes about, even as like a more artistically inclined entrepreneur versus being like a PE guy who's only looking at like a 5-year run. For me, every 8 to 10 years, you should have like a renew on a perspective or a threshold.
That's a very interesting perspective. I've not really thought about it in that kind of, you know, chunks of time. What's the next step then?
The article which went out did allude to the fact that there will be more products and garments and apparel that will fall under a different moniker, which is really exciting to have someone else say it versus me say it. But yeah, I will still continue to be a garmento, but it will be in a different, I'd say a different format. I think there's a particular format I have in mind, and I'll be pursuing that route of communicating wearable art.
Wearable art, very exciting. So Samuel, you know, looking at your career to date, you could be described as, I guess, the epitome of a multi-hyphenate: wearable art, sculpture, fragrances, product design, all of it. So I'd love to just go back to the beginning and just hear about where it all started for you, if you wouldn't mind.
Absolutely, yeah. It's interesting. I was kind of fortunately molded and shaped as a child by my parents, who are two practicing artists and educators. So my father studied at CSM and majored in fine art, but then became a stained glass procurement specialist. So he pretty much restores, you know, stained glass windows for cathedrals and churches around the world. And that is his primary occupation, as well as being like a practicing artist. And my mother is a painter, but also a lecturer, primarily sociology and psychology. I was homeschooled for a large portion of my childhood. So from quite a young age, the idea of having a regulated track didn't really exist. You know, I spent a lot of time between the Caribbean islands and then living in the UK and between Brixton and then like rural Northamptonshire. So there was this multiplicity almost to the way in which I experienced the world from quite a young age. And my parents were, and still are actually, they're closer. They are not capitalists. My family aren't. I don't really come from like a capitalist inclined background. I'm the one who's more interested in consumer goods and product. and transaction related to expression. They you know have no time for such conversations, and they won't engage in those type of conversations. So the idea of expression was always at the forefront from quite a young age. Like early memories of building pinhole cameras from scratch with my father, or you know, we were quite heavily involved within like local DIY engineering communities. If you think about like the homebrew computer PC movement of the mid to late 90s, you know, collecting archival Apple Macs was a huge part of my childhood. So that relationship to product and the idea of essence and aura of brand and expression has always kind of been baked in from quite a young age.
The collecting the archival Macs, I'd love to hear a bit more about this. What would you collect them for? Was there a use or was it more of a hobby?
I think it was more my one of my father's hobbies. You know, like he has always had this like ability to kind of identify and procure objects or vessels of I guess cultural but also expressive value. So on one side it was, you know, collecting like the Mac 2 Lisa and an early Mac, and so just having like, you know, seven or eight of these that he'd just procure and then fix and maybe use one but keep them as objects. But he'd also do the same with like, you know, Ataris as well, like really like early Atari gaming models. The same way he would also collect Sakamoto vinyls as well. So I still listen. Firstly, rest in peace. He passed only, it's only like a year or two ago now. But you know, the exposure to the arts was seminal to my identity. So there wasn't necessarily a huge crescendo moment when I went to London and went to East London and heard a particular type of music. It was already integrated within the household because we always lived between the city and the countryside and abroad. So you're always pulling in these interests, you know, some are more metropolitan interests. And on that trend cycle, which is maybe where like the industrial design and the Sakamoto comes into play, and others are more cultural interests, which might be to do with identity politics, such as being in the Caribbean. And others are just, you know, what it is to be British and grow up in rural Britain. And having that dichotomy all kind of factors into the work, I could say.
Absolutely. I guess, yeah, your early influences can have a really profound impact on who you become later on in life. So with this sort of duality between city life and rural Northamptonshire, at what age was it that you moved there? You were quite early on. Was it in your early teens? Is that right?
Oh, much younger. I was pretty much, it's interesting because the first 7 years of my life would be split primarily between 2 days in the city, 5 days in the countryside. And it was maybe around, yeah, seven or eight, I started to settle pretty much full time within the countryside. So it was this pendulum swing of like Wellingborough, Northamptonshire, and then into the midst of Brixton, Streatham, Croydon, Clapham, you know, where's the place I'm thinking of? Pulse Hill. There's another estate I really want to mention, Angeltown, which are, these are like historic, formidable boroughs which have such a strong identity of what it is to be from Southwest London. So there was never really a cutoff of sorts. It was always like drip fed in through experience.
So what was that experience like going between the two? I can imagine it's quite a stark contrast going from the city to the countryside. And I can imagine that had quite an influence on your language as a designer, but also as a person.
Completely. You know, this was the era of like New Labour as well, if we really kind of, well, the tail end of New Labour. And you had Paul Stinchcombe was the Labour constituent when I was around that age. And as a market town, it was still relatively prosperous. And you naturally had like the waves of immigrant overspill into Wellingborough over, you know, three decades or so, hence why we were also there. And it is interesting because it has a similar makeup that like Leicester has, where Leicester is the only, you know, city in the UK which has a white minority. And Wellingborough had a similar type of makeup to that, where you had a really strong South Indian or Southeast Asian community there, alongside a very strong, Afro-Caribbean community mixing with a lot of the white working class. So this idea of Britishness and growing up there was actually quite dynamic. It's quite a rarity, where you would go to, these are the novelties we all had, but you would go to like the park on the weekend and you'd see a complete integration of who you're playing cricket with, for example, or who you're playing football with. It wasn't as maybe divisive as it is now, I'd say. But to also talk about the what it was like to go to let's say Brixton on the weekends, I think that rhythm was so distinct. And I moved up full time from Brixton maybe at the age of like four. So my first, core memories, which are kind of etched into my existence, are of Brixton Market, are still of like Brixton Hill, like being carried on my mother's shoulder and just turning my head and only seeing a sea of blackness, only seeing Caribbean faces. These are my first memories of England. Is I guess when I started to age a little bit more and live outside of London, then this wider view of Britain opened up. I was also homeschooled between the age of 7 to 11. So I've gone from being in Brixton from 0 to 4, which is very, at that point, is a very controlled environment in terms of who you're exposed to in diaspora and demographic. And I've gone from being, homeschooled between the age of like 6.5 or 7 to 11, but I've spent a lot of time in the Caribbean. So there's this almost one, I was almost in one particular view of the world, which is very much a British Caribbean experience of the world. My first day at secondary school in a village called Wollaston, I literally came off a plane from St. Vincent in a Caribbean school uniform and went into class. So it was a very like British Caribbean British world and experience that I had only known up until the age of 11, you could say.
Interesting. And so, during these early years, the creative world was obviously something that was very embedded in your life as well. So did you always know that this would be something that you would pursue later on? So I know that you went to university and did graphic design and product design, for example. Was that something that you always knew that you wanted to do?
Yeah, when my dad took his MA in glass technology at De Montfort, and I went with him to the open day, and I must have been around 12 or 13. And from that moment, it was clear I'm gonna, be within the arts and be within industrial design, because I had like a role model. I had my father being so proactive within the field of like the arts, almost, lit a pathway for me that I wanted to follow. And even prior to that, my first early memories are like, selling like hand sketches and small drawings as a child at like after school clubs. And it's funny, the person I sold that drawing to now buys clothing from me and sneakers from me, 20 years later or whatnot. So this relationship to like the art merchant has always been quite clear matter I've pursued, even into selling counterfeit apparel on council estates before going into higher education or pursuing a degree. The relationship between expression and commerce is something I've been deeply engaged in for some time, I feel.
So, what was it about graphic design and product design specifically that enticed you to study it for a degree?
Yeah, I mean, initially I was going to go directly into fine art, and it was going to be a major purely in illustration. But I think the ailments were coming from like a pretty liberal house, which didn't necessarily prioritize the economics of the house, led me to make more pragmatic decisions in terms of the discipline. And there was this case of, I know I could have kind of pursued art at this time as like a 17-year-old full time, but I was concerned about what the market actually looked like at that point and where I would fit into it, and if it would kind of, satisfy the fire I have for trade as well and communication. Like the alchemy of visual communication is is so enthralling, where you emanate, you literally, you know, it's almost like burning a stick of incense, where like it conveys so much more than can be expressed through its apparition. You know, like the scent, the heaviness, the sweetness, the act itself, all of those type of semantics and semiotics are taught to you when you kind of go and pursue visual communication. And I was totally enthralled by the alchemy of that. And also early memories of, like, you know, being stimulated by Apple products and understanding it was down to like creative choices. And I wanted to be able to make those type of choices in the future to affect people.
And I guess having studied those disciplines, it does also set you up more technically for being able to create those things in the physicality. You know, you have this experience as an artist and a painter from your childhood, but I guess that could be the next logical step, I guess, learning the ropes of your craft. You then also, I guess this is when your trade started to really come into play. You know, you obviously worked with a lot of brands as a graphic designer, but you also started interning for Virgil Abloh, which is obviously quite a big milestone for you. Not only was he a friend, but he was also a big mentor. So can you tell me a bit more about this experience and what it was like working with him?
Absolutely, yeah. I remember sitting in the company I was working for, and this was the last time I had like a stationary office job. I loathe them now. I absolutely loathe them. I just went to meet, I'm definitely going to highlight this, but I just went to meet a dear friend who works for like a large corporation that we often make products with. And I don't know, like, there's just something about walking into a post-postmodern piece of architecture, which is so synthetic and just screams PE, that it's difficult to imagine kind of like living a life in that remit and routine. But to the point, this is part of why I wanted to leave working in product and industrial design at this particular time and pursued a more expressive route, which then is how I made contact with Virgil. Because I had graduated, got the first class degree, and I was scouted and was working at an industrial design company, which is brilliant. It's called Imperial Design Limited in Leicestershire. And it was on the outskirts of the city. And as you said, we'd have a plethora of commercial clients, and we'd design, you know, websites for, say, Grand Designs when they were pushing the renewable energy boom, with the first generation of solar panels for homes. And we do all the installations at Birmingham NEC and develop the website end to end. But then we'd also develop pots, pans, knives, glassware, homeware, cookware. So it was real salt of the earth, like, you know, design which maybe doesn't have a sense of radicalness to it. I did that for about a year and a half, and I pretty much lived in the office, as I've always done with any work commitment. But there came a point in time where I kind of cross-analyzed what I'd been reading and studying and what I was doing. And I didn't feel as though there was a upward trajectory which could be pursued working for like private independent design companies. So I started looking beyond that remit, and I was already kind of partaking in elements of street culture. I started a t-shirt brand when I was in university, and I was the guy at the house party who was handing out business cards for people to check out the products. You know, we got stockists in Leicester. I was doing a lot of like pasted street art at night in the city. I was, you know, scoring and self-filming short videos, which are all just part of my artistic practice. But at this time, it felt quite exploratory and it was quite undefined. And those traits would then go on to assist with working with Virgil, because he needed someone who could work across several different disciplines from like a sensibility standpoint, but also from a hard skill standpoint of, do you know how to, retouch professionally on camera raw in Lightroom, or do you know how to, you know, use Premiere Pro, or do you know how to use Final Cut? Can you score a soundtrack for me in, you know, Logic Pro X, or you know, can you produce a short animation for me in Dreamweaver, all these different software types? And because I had that curiosity across the different fields, I could do it. So he found my Instagram profile. He emailed me. And the email, I put out the email last year, it kind of circulated and it went viral for some short time. And it kind of structured how, it kind of grounded how the meet happened, because it wasn't as though he saw my profile and sent me a fire emoji and then I just got on a plane and worked with him. No, it was really formal. This is like 12 years ago at this point. I sent my portfolio over, he reviewed it with his team, and I started to intern. And off the back of the internship offer, I used that particular email to basically get a recruiter to reposition me in a London design agency. So then I've left the job in Leicester. I've moved back to London to a spare room in my aunt's house in Croydon, working 9 to 5 in Farringdon at a creative agency, whilst working, you know, 6 to 12 for Virgil and all projects that he was encapsulating. And I would just work. I would just work. It was fulfilling. You know, I'd have like my cousins running around the family table, and I'd just be on the laptop developing whatever, you know, he needed or whatever Donda needed at that time, I would be there to do, which meant also working across multiple brands that were within Virgil's network. The work then formalized. About 4 to 5 months in, I went full-time and then started traveling with Virgil to support him on activations and installations. So this is the interim period at first between Pyrex had just closed. He just released the interim Pyrex hoodie for Show Studio, and Off-White was just about to launch. So we were working on the launch of Off-White for 6 months, and then I would continue to work with him on Off-White pretty much solely at that point for another 3 years or so.
Amazing. So how did this experience shape and mould your perspective or perhaps your design language? Did you see anything developing during this time?
I think there was, it's a really interesting like prospect, which it doesn't necessarily get spoken about that much, but we were all part of third wave culture, which was this hybrid of sensibility, niche pop culture, music, and higher education. You know, so there was a mixture of having the cadences and the enjoyment and like maybe the slightly more heady experiences of what it is to be in the sphere of pop culture and to live as quote unquote a main character rather than an NPC. That was a huge part of it. And the other component was that for the most part, we had anyone who was within that group had actually studied formally. So there was an application of what had been learned, taking in the consumer habits really that we enjoyed, and we were finding ways to bring those references together. For example, if you grew up looking at, you know, Massimo Vignelli books, or if you kind of studied the impact of Saul Bass or Seymour Trost, you know, in the first half of like the 20th century, but you also understood what was happening on Tumblr at that time relating to sensibility, or relating to like, it would have been like more so Harajuku culture at this point. You know, that hadn't materialized itself into product and into one world yet. There were separate silos, and we were kind of bringing all of these components together. And I wasn't necessarily the first to do that. I was maybe the second or third wave of that. I grew up looking at a particular group of musicians who were already living in that space. And our role, like Virgil's role, my role, was to then bring the discipline of the arts and design, hard design, we'd call it, into the ether of pop culture at that particular time. So that's what we were kind of looking at. And another thing I should probably cite is that at this point, it wasn't necessarily common practice or place. And the way I look at things is quite binary. So like it wasn't commonplace to like go into a design studio or practice and see like other people of color. That wasn't normal at this point. It was more so, where do you fit in after you've graduated? So I guess we were also looking for familiarity in practices that could be created in the future that didn't exist. Because we're talking also, this is pre-David Ajay ascension as well. So there wasn't a reference point. If you look back through the history of 20th century contemporary design, cross-discipline, you can't name like five prolific African diasporic-based designers or architects or engineers. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't exist. There is no equivalent to like a Richard Rogers, or there is no equivalent to say like, well, there's not a lot of equivalents to like a Hearst. Maybe you have like a Feely, you know, and you have a few who sit within like the, on the tether ends of the YBA canon, who are now starting to get their laurels. But at this point, it was very difficult to kind of figure out where do you go with your cultural experience and hard skills. And I guess this is where, you know, the intrigue of Donda was quite important, because it was proposing a different type of creative agency for creative professional creative practitioners.
So who would you say were your key design influences or people besides your parents, perhaps, that you looked up to, you know, in that kind of world?
Benelli for sure. Massimo Benelli and Leila Benelli were huge influences. Absolutely. You know, the fact that they could work cross discipline between, you know, we're talking like they left when they left Italy in like, God, like the early 40s, I believe. I think they left Italy in the early 40s and obviously kind of resettled and patriated to become New Yorkers, and then went on to impact, like, you know, the entire visual system for the underground and, well, their subway system, onto the work they did in apparel, into homeware. I think they represented this like multiplicity that our generation has interpreted through different mediums. But the Maya Briggs example already existed with them. And it's the same for like, and obviously like a Noguchi is up there as well, who had this tension point, this ambiguity between, you know, functional object and sacred object, and the effigy of the artist and the designer being slightly more blurred was a deep interest. There was something about those two in particular, I would, and obviously Mark Newson has to be there as well, just the impact and reach he had. And they all, the triptych that are cited, all live between the space of functional and sacred, which means that you get the security of commerce and trade and commission, which means you can plug into, you know, capitalist agenda. But on the other side, there are these deep, you know, almost mythological truths which are embedded within like the minutiae of what it is to be a human, that you can tap into in the arts through form and through, you know, storytelling. So I would say those particular names were the main interests. And, you know, if you were to speak to like a Jound, or if he was here, he would cite likely the same kind of interest if we're talking particularly about, you know, design and object.
You can really get a feel of those influences throughout your entire portfolio, I think. And, you know, you went on to found your own label, A Cold Wall, in 2015. And even that is sort of a mashup of industrial design, functional art, wearable art, and sportswear. So what were your reasons for setting up that label? What really provoked it?
Yeah, I think there were two components to it. The first is, I'd spent the last like 4 years of my life, it's not that long amount of time to be fair, like traveling with and becoming part of a global creative community, which is primarily based in America. So if you kind of look at that canon of who was part of Virgil's contemporaries and who he reported into, they're all American. I don't really need to name, but if I go through like four of the names, like Jerry Heron, Justin Saunders, obviously Virgil himself, or whether it's like, you know, the gen who built Donda, they're all American. I'm British and European. So after kind of traveling on these excursions, it was clear that whatever I had to say within that class of consumer goods wasn't going to be what they had to say, because the origin story is completely different, though the affinity and understanding of the American experience or the global experience was there. So when I kind of, you know, decided it was time to move on from working with Virgil directly on a day-to-day basis, I had already started prototyping products for a cold war. I think there was actually, there was a slight overlap. I think there was like a 6 month, 7 month overlap actually, where a cold war debuted on maybe the 2nd of January, 2015, by way of a GQ article that Jake Wolf wrote. And by early summer, it would have been April, May SS delivery for Selfridges. We did a talk, and on the panel talk, it's myself, Virgil, Tremaine, and Maury. This is well before Denim Tears and a few others. By the end of the summer, I had decided to leave that role and work full-time on pursuing and building a cold war. And the actual crux of it was really from a thesis, a dissertation that I wrote at the end of my studies, which was the alchemic properties of how apparel and menswear can transform and move you across different class systems. The only difference was a Cold War's focus was more about capturing the unseen at this point. This whole architectural projection that comes from, you know, the underclass and the working class experience and the environments and palettes and textures, but also the sharing of materials between, let's say, South Kensington and Lewisham, and how material becomes the denominator of class through architecture. It all kind of stemmed from a life experience, and then it was about conveying that through product. And the beauty of that narrative is that because it's all just like a postmodern experience, you can scale it and project it on most, you know, macro economies, which is why a Cold War was able to be applied into different demographics quite easily, actually.
The idea of alchemy is a very interesting notion, and I know it's something that you speak of often throughout your practice. So can you just tell me a little bit more about that as a sort of meaning, and also how you apply that through your work, whether it's through materiality, architectural, brutalist aesthetics? How does that transcend?
Really, yeah, I'd actually like to talk about alchemy, because if I think about the it's interesting, the demographics I speak to and how they interpret that word. As you said, I think it's an incredible word, and it's the etymology behind it is so rife and rich and appropriate. But there's interest, it's interesting to see how other demographics consider that word to still be a sense of sacrilege. There is one side that I've engaged with when I purport the word, which are probably, well, they're far more conservative, and the word has a completely different meaning to them, where it's still seen as some type of macabre darkness. But the way I look at it is in much more of a return to human values that carry some type of essence to them, and the act of transforming material through conceptual thinking and through rigor and through trial. And it also touches into the idea of like sentience beyond a top level experience, which is really important, because then you start talking about material compositions and the response of, let's say, heat or different, basically how composites respond to one another, which kind of has a sense of revelation in what a material has to say, which would assume that a material is sentient, which is great, because then you start talking about other creation myths from different cultures. So the word alchemy is interesting because at its crux, it's about reawakening a sense of what it is to be human. And it kind of dislodges us away from a slightly more imperial way of looking at the function of materials and the place of materials. I know that is quite lofty, but then you start getting into the idea of, you know, the four humors, or you start getting into the idea of, I probably need you both to remind me on this. What's, there's the traditional Japanese belief system, that animism starts to come up, and all these other topics, which are about the human experience and not about the Anglo-Christian experience, come up and are opened up when you use language and vernacular such as alchemy. So there's a whole kind of like rhetoric as to why those words are being chosen to talk about material transformation and what it may mean.
It's very interesting. So what would you say is the function of materiality in your point of view?
I think it's about unlocking or uncovering new attributes from materials that we believe we know well. Is very interesting. And I think there's lots of critiques come up there, because if you kind of take like a sheet of OSB or plywood and you apply heat to it, all of the synthetic composites and adhesives start to raise to the surface. And it's as though the material is speaking to you, or like revealing. There's a revelation of how it's made, which in our way of engaging with material, we're actually quite far away from. It's like with our food, for the most part. You know, we're so far away from whole foods at this point, it's a real disappointment. So we don't actually understand what we are kind of consuming or engaging with. And it's the same with like surfaces and materials and microplastics. It's all the same. And this idea of alchemy has a tension of taboo and truth, cross-culture, which maybe captures the veil of uncertainty that we have to fast consumption and the availability of material, which is not really something which is sustainable. So there is a little bit of sustainability which is factored in there. But for me, it's more focused, to answer your question, it's much more focused on finding revelations in material or unveiling the imperfect as a truth, and then allowing the truth to be the enticing component of an object or a form or of a material. It's always about trying to like move the smog out of the way almost.
I like that point of view a lot. I've also read that you described your clothing as armor for the now, which I thought was a really interesting stance, that clothing can be viewed as a protective armor for the body, and therefore the materiality is a protective armor. So can you tell me a little bit more about that notion?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's like the history and personification of what we want particular items in menswear to deliver. You know, I think about like a brass or bronze chest plate, and I think about the gilets that we create, and it's the same type of vernacular or archetypes that are age old. You know, that, and it's how do you kind of recontextualize what's already known and make sure that it's appropriately placed for modernity. And I guess part of my contribution to menswear is trying to correct a particular, like what masculinity can be, and tapping into some of those antiquated views, you know, I feel kind of relevant in the dichotomy of how we engage with image and identity. For example, it's not by chance that the viral meme of last month or December of how often do you think about Rome also translates to the trend cycle of how many gilets we've been able to sell that have a tension in the pleating that is reflective of two millennia of armor. It's all within the same type of channel of thought when it comes to like the psyche of menswear and the truth in how men often want to feel when they buy clothes from you know, my particular ilk of designers. And it's not, the ilk isn't a race or diaspora thing. It's more a proposition of what menswear and masculinity could potentially be. And we often frack and mine that and try to refine it and clean it up, but leave elements of it quite feral and open, which goes back down to the idea of what it is to remove the smog and to remove the synthetic layer of, I guess, what it is to exist now, and what it is to be part of the day-to-day norms, you could say. We found that even, I mean, the resurgence of athleticism is also tied to this wanting for, I don't know, something which feels slightly more assured and maybe not aged, but as though it comes from some type of genealogy or lineage of sorts when it comes to identity. And of course, clothing is a huge proponent of that, you know.
One of your signature pieces, which is acquired by the V&A, the Converge Gilet, I think encapsulates that very well. It harks back to sort of ancient artifacts, the stone used in sculpture. Can you tell me a bit more about that piece in particular?
You know, there's two games, I guess, with fashion, which is really interesting. One, you've got to meet the audience halfway because they're there for the product, not for the thesis. So it's finding a way to encapsulate all of that through like a visual language, and also just the feeling when the clothes are put on, all of that study comes into play. And I think the gilet is a good example of trying to solve a problem through fashion. And the problem is more, what can I wear to make me feel as though I do exist within the historical canon of masculinity? And that vest answers that question. Now, not every product we make needs to fall into that type of archetype or thinking, but we found commercially that's where there seems to be a want and a desire. When we have done, you know, softer mesh, slightly more like exaggerated proportions or delicate garments, we tend to not, from our particular brands, we tend to not see the same type of demand. Whereas the vest also shifts the proportions of how your upper body looks. You know, it creates a tension around the collarbones and the necks. So you look more, you could say, slightly more aggressive almost. It almost taps into the same type of aura that Massimo Osti brands are able to achieve as well.
So after this, you know, moving on from a cold wall, you then also veered more into product design and launched your own design studio, SRA. I'd love to hear a little bit more about how you shifted into this realm and your reasons for starting up this studio.
Yeah, I feel the shift occurred, you know, SRA is now turning 4 years old. So the shift occurred, it would have been early 2019 is when I first put together the business model for what SRA could potentially solve. And a part of it is kind of, again, looking for these ways to extend a particular perspective and sensibility beyond clothing, but into more of a world and an ether, you know, because you start thinking about the blazer, the pant, the short, the attire, and what feeling that has to offer. But then you start thinking about the environment itself, you know, and then you start thinking about the temperature and the scent and the type of experience you'd like to be paired with the garments, which brings you into solid object and form. And then you start thinking about maybe how some of the virtues or perspectives that you hold in fashion could also be applied to public space. And I also partly found that for the rigor of conversation I wanted to have, the arts and design felt slightly more appropriate, whereas fashion is more so based on the servitude and the experience that you offer the end user. The rigor was more suited to design and the art. So we launched it after winning the Hublot Design Prize at Serpentine Gallery in 2019. And, you know, we've been working on material developments with Nike at that point, which were also debuted at Serpentine. And we've gone on to kind of toe this line between, on one end, we're deeply focused on like product marketing and brand marketing. It's not necessarily about the tension of a wingtip TPU in the back of your ear on a bud that I'm focused on. I'm focused on the external experience and the soliciting of what shape, form, color, and material and scale and environment have to offer. It's very much experiential design that we kind of focus on. And it's a lot of it is trying to identify problems and solutions for particular groups that we wish to work with. So there's this intellectual rigor that comes from the process of almost having a sense of consultation and the dialogue with, let's say, an LVMH group or an Apple group or a Nike group that being within the industrial product design space can offer. And it actually kind of blossomed out of the depth of partnership we were establishing with collaborators in fashion, then started to factor into the other elements almost end to end.
So what kind of problems and solutions are we referring to here? Can you give some examples?
It's difficult to, because they're all public companies, so I have to be very careful what I say in terms of problems and solutions. But I think it's more having a observation based on the volume of travel and the exposure to different demographics and markets cross continent gives you a read of how people feel about particular products and why they feel that way, whether it be brand or buy or about product, or whether it be physical or public space, or whether it be retail, and being part of that tornado of exposure, it's highly beneficial to be able to steer product cycles, or to be able to steer or solicit newness that doesn't exist. You know, for example, if no one is producing a rubberized headphone, but everyone's complaining about the lack of grip on the interior earband of a headphone in every geography that you visit, you have the data, or you have the insights to understand where the problem lies and then potentially how it can be rectified for a partner. And that might first come out in a collaborative product, but then the success of that collaboration totally skews the opportunity that the partner could have for their inline product. And then the consultation may open up in quite an organic way. There's always a proof of concept before these partnerships tend to open up, I'd say. And some of them are actually quite long-standing relationships now. You know, the Nike relationship dates back, maybe to 2013. And, you know, the Apple relationship dates back maybe to 2020 in terms of it being front-facing, when I kind of reviewed a debut of an Apple Watch and wrote some prose about that for wallpaper per se. So these are long form, not really collaborations, but dynamics and partnerships, I would say, more so than being cut and dry white label service design.
So the studio as a whole has this very sort of industrial but also artisanal mindset, which I think is a really interesting pairing. You know, industrial is perceived as, you know, for the masses, while artisanal is very traditional, I guess, less mechanical. So how does this play out in the processes and materials of your creations?
That's a really good question. I think that it plays out specific to, as you can imagine, the particular project or like the needs of the client. Like there are times where as a brand and as an identity, having that tension point between, you know, the ultra harsh industrial perspective, the synthesized perspective, and then having the artisanal craft and quite whimsical ephemeral perspective work really well in terms of like a visual literacy. And there's this tension point, which means there's no fatigue in terms of what the audience experience. And you're tapping into all types of mythology tied to craft and heritage and location and like the British archetype and identity. And it can sometimes soften and make it more approachable by using, you know, figurines and characters and animation and archetype. On the other side, you've got the pristine, at times quite analytical arm, which is asymmetry, you know, synthetic use of color, or the richness that we're using is almost a a VR and AR richness that exists in real life, which is built for digital consumption, but also is quite striking in physical. And that is, those are the two pillars and codes of the house, you could say. Now, when it comes to clients and to partnerships, sometimes it's not about supplementing those codes into their world. At other times, it's more taking the, it's more of a culture thing at times when it's the rigor of the studio being applied to their practice, which is where they're more so trying to absorb the way of thinking and problem solving and the design culture to not necessarily even reposition, but to just simply understand how such elastic thinking can exist for billion-dollar corporations. So to a degree, you almost operate more so as a think tank or a innovation hub, which is satellite for some of these some of these partners. And it also means, due to, you know, like corporate structures, we are the partner that can at times, you know, speak from Mount Vesuvius with the stat sheet to assist in moving conversations forward that the partners probably know is already the truth, but maybe just needed the affirmation to loosen the belt or be slightly more elastic and to get the read on what else is happening within the market. It's more the vigilance component and the it's more about the vigilance, really. That's what we really try to deliver to them.
So I'm also aware that you moved on to painting, which obviously you practiced when you were younger. And this was a discipline that you picked up during COVID, obviously a time for us all to pause and think and try something new and build that relationship with craft again. Can you tell me a bit more about this period in time and how this interlinks with all of your other past and present disciplines as well?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I never actually intended to share any of the paintings I was producing. I've been painting now for maybe like 4 years, 5 years. And I had met with Tim Marlowe, the CEO of the Design Museum, a few years ago. And we had been just discussing several projects and we would catch up and have these wider conversations about what's happening culturally. And obviously Tim was the previous artistic director for White Cube. So we were speaking and we were talking about this relationship between design and fine art and like the multitude of activities that exist within like an artist's practice. And I had shown him a selection of paintings just you know, casually that I'd been working on, and he graciously introduced me to Susan May, who's the artistic director currently globally for White Cube. And we had, you know, gone through quite like a traditional process of studio visits and discussing concepts and ideas, and really there felt like there was a, from her perspective, an affinity that she saw, which had a tension between the fine arts and design that captured a feeling for a particular generation, our generation, the millennial generation, that felt like it belonged in the historic canon of the arts. And hence why the show then came together. And I thought it quite important to show, you know, a slightly more intimate and private component of my practice, which is fundamentally like a huge part of who I am before it is a product. And this is why also abstraction was selected versus figuration, which is trending for Black artists. I have no interest in figuration. I think it's absurd. You know, honestly, I have no interest in it at all. Not to say that there aren't incredible portraiture painters and drawers out there, but I have no interest in the external and just replicating that. I think that to simply purport physiology and, you know, it feels a bit trite at times. I'm much more interested in the interior self that we all have to offer, being much more of like a common denominator of the human experience and like how wide one's nose is. It's nonsensical. Hence why abstraction was selected. And when I think about artists who come before me, such as Frank Bowling, you know, born in British Guyana, or I think of Reginald Sylvester or I think of Sterling Ruby, who all kind of mitigate the space of abstraction, the relationship it has to filling voids that haven't necessarily been documented, because the voids are based on undocumented experiences, feels far more important than figuration. So I've been developing these quite dramatic gestural abstract paintings and drawings for some time, which are deeply personal, but it felt right to show them, especially at this time, considering, you know, with the sale of the Cold War only being announced this week, you could imagine certain departures were starting to occur around the time where my relationship with the arts and painting is starting to pick up. So there's a bit of a mental shift of, you know, scaling a company to whatever number, opening global stores and wanting to get back to a much more intimate process of expression. And that's where the desire to paint and maybe communicate some of those paintings, which I'm grateful sold very well, even though I don't really care about that, but they did sell well, started to come into fruition. So I continue to paint, and I'm in a place where I'm now considering the type of relationship I want to have with the art world, you know, the straddling the line of partaking in solo shows when appropriate, but also not necessarily becoming employed by the art world, because, you know, I don't necessarily, that's not necessarily the pursuit I have. The pursuit is much more of like a historic pursuit of filling voids of untold stories in a particular medium of painting rather than art for money, because I already trade commercially in two other disciplines. Thus, I wouldn't wish to trade, which is so close to my sense of self or my essence. At that point, there's nothing sacred. And the art space is the one space, or the painting practice, the one component which is incredibly sacred to me and still remains to be quite private, actually.
It sounds like painting for you is a much more personal journey than perhaps your other disciplines, say product design, graphic design, all of it, fashion. And it sounds like it's a bit of a place of respite for you, perhaps. I feel like everyone needs that kind of outlet where there isn't perhaps an end goal. It's just you're making something for the joy. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I guess my main, you know, my main interest in the arts is more so the relationship with, you know, current thinkers and generational thinkers. So I'm working on this new lifer at the moment called, actually, I probably shouldn't name, I will say the name, called titled Heave. And it's a 600-page book of paintings and drawings and prose and thinking and poetry. Initially, it was, you know, I was thinking, should this release of a gallery? And actually, no, it's not necessarily about that. It's more about the thinkers and the commentators of our particular generation, maybe more so than like latching on to the leading generation of Gen Xers. I'm more interested at what the millennial and Gen Z generation has to say about what's happening as, you know, commentary within the arts. So Jonah Freud will, you know, write the opening foreword for the book, and there may be one or two other curators or critics who really are part of the architecture of the arts who will also contribute to the book. But it's not about the book itself being an object to be bought. It's more about the historical canon of where the book exists within the arts and whom is critiquing the art, who already belongs to the canon. So it's much more about the one-to-one relationships within the sector versus the focus on trading within the sector, if that makes sense. I know I'm talking quite a lot about it, but I've spent some time thinking about the right tension rod and dynamic to have with the sector.
So obviously you have a new collaboration with Collar, and this is a smart toilet. And this is, I believe, your second collaboration. You launched the sink last year at Miami. So yeah, can you tell me a bit more about this design piece and the concept behind it?
Completely. You know, my main focus with Collar has been, well, there's two things. You know, as a private a highly successful private family-run organization, they have the elasticity to iterate and offer a spirit of newness as they please, which means that there's a sense of experimentation and openness that is encouraged through their previous partnerships and within this, you know, co-partnership that we've developed, which really is a co-studio. You know, it's the SRA industrial and architectural team working with the Kola industrial and architectural team, and it's a complete integration. And that enables for a relatively like pure conversation around expression to factor into form and into product and into environment. And I think practically, my main interest in Kola has always been the volumes of water that they help, well, the volumes of water that are, you know, transmitted and transported globally, and Kola being vessels for the delivery of the water is very interesting. You know, the delivery of safe water globally for like an optimistic perspective of how you engage with water through color and material and through form historically has always been quite poignant and quite sharp within their catalog of products. And the vertical development of concept to casting on site in Kola as a manufacturer is incredible to see. It's the same verticality you see in, you know, other family-run billion-dollar companies around the world. And to see that culture and process and engineering that exists in place is highly enticing as, like, you know, and I guess like an artistic entrepreneur who has founded two small companies, to be able to speak to the family, to be able to speak closely to the CEO and work with the design directors, and exchange openly ideas and perspectives. You know, like, so much of the partnership structure isn't necessarily just about the product. It's about how we'll fundamentally experience product in reality and digitally. So if you think about the dot-com experience, it will tell you, you know, local humidity through geotagging. It will tell you rainfall within your area. You're able to see the product in front of you as a digitized, gamified experience and explore that on an X, Y, and Z axis, as well as zoom in and zoom out and change the color profile and play with the function of the tap before you even purchase it. Alongside that, when you actually do engage with the product in person, several questions come up, and the questions that come up arise in the same way as experiencing, let's say, the first time you see a Henry Moore sculpture in Kensington Park, of who, what, why, how, and when. You know, there's this tension of newness that is brought about the ambiguity of the forms, which is what young designers should be doing. We're supposed to try and discern what is next versus just copy another bloody postmodern design or mid-century design. It's already happened. It's dead. We can't live as ghosts in like a previous shadow. We need to churn for newness in the future. And that's my job as an artist and designer, is to go into darkness and find newness through shape, through form, through material, through language, and through experience. And I think that the fact in which when you engage with both the toilet and the sink, you will not know what these objects are until you touch the objects and go close to the objects and explore the function of the objects, is part of the strength of the forms, is that they solicit you to engage with them from a curiosity standpoint, from an expressive standpoint, and also from an engineering standpoint, where we've filed multiple patents on material, on water flow along this process. It's a really special and rare project that will push the needle in water solutions and how they are delivered for decades to come. It is an advent shift.
And why the color orange? I know that this is your signature color that features quite heavily throughout a lot of your creations. So why did you decide on this one?
Yeah, orange belongs to design, not to me. we use it a lot. And it I mean, just the semantic, it covers so much, right? Like, it captures this sense of like the industrious metropolitan hub. It is a color which is, you know, daring and vigilant, but doesn't necessarily solicit danger or anger. There's a power dynamic of how orange affects scenography and how it pulls the eye in, which is really interesting to play with. The richness of it converts from like physical to digital so well. It's youthful, it's optimistic. There's a sense of timeless disruption because orange has really been used in the same way for the past like 80 years, you know, but it also represents the advent of technology. It's the first time we started to see like TPE and TPUs and rubbers be molded and cast and formed. So it's this advent of like modernity, which is etched into its inception of how it's been used. And in this instance, you know, orange still kind of has this trope of iconic design, which is really interesting to signal. There's a boldness and a complexity to it that, you know, how I guess the complexity is more so how different materials absorb orange and take to orange, you know, whether it's more like a mineral base or whether it's an epoxy or whether it's rubberized or whether it's like sheet metal. The color has so much dynamism to it whilst still delivering a sense of like uniform. So it's appropriate for use, you know. I could go on about this color so heavily, why it's used in like a public space and yada, yada, yada. But there's so much, just like cross-analyzing the right color spectrum to leverage when it comes to communicating, you know, slightly more asymmetrical or radical ideas or thinking, and orange just kind of fits the bill quite well. It ticks those boxes.
Absolutely. I think it's a good place to leave it there. I think we've covered some good ground today, and I'm very conscious of time, so I won't leave you here too long. But thank you so much, Samuel. It's been really great to chat to you about your incredible journey and all of the amazing projects you've done. So yeah, thank you so much.
It's a joy. Thank you for your time.